I'm Patty Kiley. I am 69 years old. Today's date is March 5th, 2020. I am in Las Cruces, New Mexico, actually at New Mexico State University at the moment. And my interview partner is Rick Kiley, and he is my husband of many, many, many years.
Hi, I'm Rick Kiley. I'm 74 years old. Today is March 5th, 2020. I'm on the campus of New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, New Mexico. My interview partner is my wife, Patty, Patty with an I, P-A-T-T-I. And again, she is my wife. So we've been thinking about this a little bit, huh, Patty?
Yeah, we have.
And I believe that what we're trying to convey today is a story about love and war and, most importantly, correspondence. Because this was long before email and long before any social media. It was written correspondence. It was snail mail. And I think what we're going to talk about today is how two young people, one a teenager and the other a little bit older, we were 17, you were, and I was 22, and we grew together through writing these letters from the United States over to Vietnam, where I was, and we formed a bond that has lasted decades.
Yeah, it was very different communicating back then, because it used to take a full week to get from me to you, and vice versa.
A lot of overlap with the letters.
Yeah, a lot of overlap with the letters. Yeah, exactly. In that fall of 1967, I was living in a relatively small town, Florham Park, New Jersey, and you lived in Union, New Jersey, and there was a brand new mall that everybody was very excited about opening in Short Hills, New Jersey, and at the mall was a Bloomingdale's.
Yeah.
Now, Bloomingdale's was a big thing because it was in New York City, so for one to come out to the suburbs in New Jersey was really, really cool. I could only go to work two nights a week and Saturday because I was still going to high school. And I worked full weeks times in the summer times. And we used to have lunch together.
That's right. And like you said, you were in high school. I was in college. I was a student at Fairleigh Dickinson University. I was in the night school. And I think we said this, but I am 5 years older than you.
Yeah, well, and after that first, what would be the first part of 1968, when I graduated from high school, I was set to go to Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania in the fall. And at almost the same time that happened, you got your draft notice, because we were drafting people back then. What was that like?
Well, that's right. I was drafted into the Army. And I found out that I had a report on October 1st, 1968, and it was a bit frightening. And I had mixed emotions about the whole experience.
I'm sure you did, because it was a time of amazing turmoil for the country with that war. What were your mixed emotions?
Well, I wasn't sure if our involvement in the war was right. And what I mean by ours is the United States. And a lot of people and a lot of my friends were against the war. And
mine too.
Found out ways to avoid serving, which wasn't that hard if you were white, educated. I had friends who got deferments for being teachers and things like that. I remember I was supporting Bobby Kennedy for president, and that was in 1968, before I got drafted. And then I supported Eugene McCarthy after Bobby was killed, and Bobby was killed on June 6, 1968. Martin Luther King was assassinated in the same year.
Yeah, 1968 was a heck of a year.
Right. I do want to say that not only did I understand that I was legally obligated to go into the Army, but but I felt that I had a moral obligation to support my country. And quite honestly, there were a lot of things going on, which maybe we can talk about later, but I thought if I did figure out a way out, somebody else would have gone in my place, and I wasn't feeling very good about that. And what I'm not sure about is how you're out in central Pennsylvania, and I'm in eastern New Jersey, and how did you find out that I was drafted?
Well, there was always a long weekend in October, and I usually came home. It was only 3 to 4 hours from home in Jersey, in central Pennsylvania. And because I had so many friends at Bloomingdale's, I would usually stop in whenever I was home, even if I wasn't working. It was kind of fun because we both worked in the men's department. It was kind of cool for me because I had two sisters and knew nothing about men's clothes before I started working there. Anyway, but I would stop in over a long weekend, and then that was how I found out.
Okay. You and I reconnected again after I finished basic training at I took my basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey. I wasn't too far away from home, but that's where I did basic, Fort Dix.
Yep.
We reconnected.
And we went out together New Year's Eve.
Yeah. I asked you out on a date. It was my first date, our first date.
Right.
Yeah. And our boss, who was a really good guy, a young guy, not a whole lot older than we were, had a New Year's Eve party. And it was fun to go with you, and it was a fun party. There was a lot of drinking, though, and I drank too much. And it was deemed that I couldn't drive, and our host had to drive you home.
I remember that. And so then we sort of stayed out of touch for a year.
Right. And that's because I was ashamed.
Yeah, I can understand that.
And I didn't know what to say to you or how to communicate with you about what had happened. And also, I was confused about a lot of stuff, and I didn't know if I really wanted to start a relationship. I was pretty sure I was going to Vietnam. I was kind of on track. You know, we kind of knew, those of us that had been drafted, what was happening. And I was going to be an infantryman. And it was around that time at New Year's, I had orders to go to Fort Polk, Louisiana for advanced infantry training. And pretty much everybody that went to Fort Polk, Louisiana was going to go to Vietnam. That's pretty much what happened. So for me, the way I was thinking to try to start a relationship with you or, you know, anybody wasn't really what I wanted to do at the time. Obviously, we'll see later how that changed for me. After I went through Fort Polk advanced infantry training, I volunteered for and was accepted at the NCO Academy, NCO School, Non-Commissioned Officer School at Fort Benning, which is the base for the infantry. And I went to school there, and that takes us up to like June of 1969. What happened there was I graduated, and I was became a sergeant, E5, even though I had only been in the Army like half a year. And I was sent back to Fort Dix for additional training and also to help train other soldiers that were in advanced infantry training. So the odd thing about that, considering what happened, is we were both in New Jersey. And logically, I could have contacted you then, and I didn't. And I don't know why. I guess I do, but we already covered that. So that kind of brings us up to October of 69, and I arrived in Vietnam on October 1st. And I was assigned to the 2nd Battalion of the 327th Infantry of the 101st Airborne Division. And we had a motto that was no slack. Do you know what that means?
Absolutely not.
No slack means that even though we were in a war zone, we always had to keep all our equipment clean and straight. There was no facial hair, at least at the beginning. We shaved, and we really kept our act together. And I think that no slack attitude saved a lot of lives. There was a high level of preparedness in that unit. I went to training at the at CERTS, which was the Screaming Eagle Replacement Training School, and that was up in Benoit. I landed in Cameron Bay. And I remember being at CERTS, and I was on guard duty up there one night, and I was a New York Mets fan back then. And I remember on guard duty, we were able to get a radio, and we listened to the second game of the World Series between the Baltimore Orioles and the New York Mets. And I didn't look it up. I don't know who won. I'm pretty sure the Mets lost the first game, but ultimately they did win that series. There was a lieutenant with me in the bunker that night. We were listening to the game, and he was also assigned to the company that I was ultimately assigned to. Different platoons, but same company. And about 6 weeks after that night, he was killed in action. And I remember being profoundly sad about that.
Was he the first one that you knew when you got over there that was killed?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure so. So by then, did you know I was in Vietnam? Now it's like October of 69. It's not a question I got drafted. It's like, now I'm over there.
Yeah. Well, it's that long weekend in October.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's how I figured it. That's how I got it. Was going down there, and they told you had been in contact with the folks at Bloomingdale's, and you know, there you were, over in Vietnam.
Yeah, it was strange. So anyway,
so what were you doing in October and November then?
So, first of all, I already told you about the training school. Then I got assigned to my unit, which was up in a place called Phu Bai, and nobody could see it, but I got a map on the table, and that was that was up in the just below the DMZ, below the demilitarized zone.
Right, you were very, very far north.
Yeah, it was south of Hue, but north of Da Nang. Phu Bai was where Camp Eagle was, and there was a glitch for some reason. For about the first week, 5 weeks I was there, I didn't receive any mail from anybody.
That was just weird.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Who when you finally got mail, you probably got a bunch. Who'd you get it from?
I got a load of mail. And friends, my parents, my two brothers, my sister, their families. But I did get a lot of letters from little nieces that I had.
You got a lot of those.
I got a lot of nieces. Got a lot of nieces. And that was very special to me. And, you know, when we got married, it was very important for me that those kids got to go to the wedding and go to the wedding reception. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. We had a lot of kids at that wedding.
It was a really cool kids' table.
Oh, they were
all very cute.
They were very cute.
Now they're all grown up.
One of them was actually in the wedding party. So,
yeah.
They're quite a diversity in ages. I think it was was all the way down to, I think the youngest one there was six, and there was only one who couldn't come because he'd just been born.
Yeah, it was like 6 months old.
Yeah.
He's still around. But those little girls and those nephews, they grew up to have children, and some of them have grandchildren. So, you know, you asked me what was October and November like. It was the no mail, and then we talked about the kids, that was so important. You know, I was in the infantry.
Right.
And that's a foot soldier. And that's a foot soldier that carries a rifle.
And you know it confuses everybody when you tell them with the 101st Airborne that you were an infantryman.
There wasn't a lot of jumping out of airplanes over in Vietnam, but the 101st Airborne, we were air mobile. We went from one place to another in helicopters. We rappelled out of helicopters on ropes. We landed in landing zones on helicopters. But the 101st Airborne never changed its name, as it should not have, from airborne to air mobile.
Right.
Because of their storied history in World War II, being part of the D-Day invasion. Those guys were something. Those World War II guys. I started out, remember now I'm a sergeant.
Right.
At three stripes, so I'm a squad leader. And at that time, when I first got there, I had very good leadership. I had a career sergeant. He was an E7. And he really showed me the ropes as best as he could. And I learned a lot from him in a very short period of time. We were in the lowlands, we called it. The South China Sea was off in a little bit in the distance. Some days I could see it. Where I was primarily, it was all agrarian. It was rice paddies. There were highways, there were railroads, trails. And I got there, it was monsoon season. And it, rained all the time. It really rained a lot, and it rained frequently. A lot of what I did was I trained, occasionally anyway, we trained soldiers from the, we called them ARVNs, which I believe was Army of the Republic of Vietnam soldiers. During the night, we set up ambushes around villages where we were. And the reason we set up ambushes is because the Viet Cong, the enemy, wanted to go into those villages at night for a variety of reasons. They could get food. They could get sex. They could keep their political point of view growing and so forth. And sometimes they would go in and actually assassinate a village chief if he wasn't in alignment with their political views. So our ambushes were very important, and they did a lot of that. It was sometimes nothing happened, and you're going to hear later, I think, sometimes things did happen on those ambushes. I remember the Vietnamese people being much smaller than I expected them to be. They were very friendly to us, sometimes sort of giggly and childlike. Looking back at it, I'm sure that they were scared of us. We were bigger. We carried rifles. Who knows? Maybe what we could have done. But I'll tell you, the people I was with and myself, we were very nice to those villagers. And I'm sure some of them hated us. I want to be clear about something in this interview, that I was always in a combat situation. Sometimes people say, well, you must have gone to the PX or this or done that. And no, we were always in combat. Even when I was at our big base camp, remember I'd write
Camp
to you about
Eagle.
Camp
right.
Eagle. And we'd go in there on stand downs for a couple of reasons. One, they wanted to give us rest away from the daily combat, but there was training going on and all sorts of things. And one thing, as I was thinking about this interview, is even when we were back at Camp Eagle, it wasn't safe. And one night I remember we were watching a movie, which was outdoors. It was sort of like going to the drive-in movie, except without cars. And we were watching a movie called The Battle of Britain. And during the Battle of Britain, the Nazis were bombing a British airfield. And the sound got very realistic during the bombing raid because we were getting mortared. And we all ran for foxholes and things like that. That was really something. It wasn't the first time I saw real action, but I happen to know the date. On the 19th of November, 1969, I was second in command of one of these ambushes. And we killed an enemy, and we captured two assault weapons called AK-47s, and I was second in command, and for that I received the Army Commendation Medal for Valor.
Yeah, I've seen that at the house, yes.
It's on the wall.
Yes, it is.
I first heard from you in early December 1969, and this sort of started, really, or restarted everything between you and me, and, like, what caused you to write to me?
You had sent a Christmas card to the men's department at Bloomingdale's, and they, when they opened it, they also kept the envelope, which had your address on it. So I said to myself, this is ridiculous that we're not having any kind of communication at all. So I wrote you a letter. And I was missing contact. So I wrote you a letter. I don't know if – I forget if it was a card/letter, but it was – I think it was probably
– It was a letter.
It was a letter. Yeah. Okay. And your writing started up. But I'm sure you were sort of surprised to hear from me. But yours was fairly – could be intermittent. It wasn't like it was coming all the time.
Yeah. What was that? Like, there were gaps in writing. Was that concerning to you? I mean,
sure it was, because once we started writing, I didn't know if anybody knew besides me that I was writing to you. And if anything had happened to you, nobody was going to know – that, oh, maybe I would like to know that there was something going on, because I didn't know, and I didn't know anybody to get in contact with. I didn't know any of your family or, I mean, I'm sure something would have come through to the department at Bloomingdale's, but that, you know, I didn't have any real way of getting in touch with anybody. So when it goes, you know, and this was kind of weird, the fact that it would take so long to get the letters back and forth. You know, you'd think that it would be faster than a week, but it was. It was at least a week to get, once you wrote it and stuck it in the mail, you know, it took a week to get to the other end and then maybe to get an answer a week later.
Hard to believe.
Yeah.
Compared to today. And there was, in fact, almost a month's lag from that first letter and then my second letter to you, because you saved those letters. Thank you, you know, for doing that.
Got them all.
And part of the thing I remember was I was on a sniper mission, and that's not as exotic as it may sound. I didn't have a big, long sniper rifle with a sight on it, but there were like a little team of three of us that they sent way out away from everybody else, and there was a trail, and we were waiting for bad guys, to come in there. But after that, our writing really picked up. I mean, there's sometimes when in review, I'd find out I'd get three letters from you at a time. I think we were started to write almost daily.
Yep.
And you could kind of tell that we were developing, I call it a courtship by mail, and mm-hmm. we were kind of developing a high level of affection for each other through the letters. And I don't know, what was going through your mind with that?
Well, you know, we started using more affectionate terms with each other, so I was kind of liking that.
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You had a crush on me.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I wasn't that little.
You were not the little girl anymore.
I wasn't that little girl anymore.
That's for sure.
And I even had, I don't think you know this, I even had a countdown calendar on my wall.
No, I don't know that. This is the first time I've heard that. One of the things you did to point out to me that you weren't a little girl anymore, and I don't know if it was then or later, but you sent me this picture of you from the Jersey Shore, and you're wearing this yellow bikini or two-piece bathing suit, and you look pretty grown up. And that's hey, that, she's pretty
cute. Well, you still got the picture, so
yeah. Actually, it's on the table between the two of us right at this moment, because I brought it along today as a reminder. So in late December through early February, the action where I was seemed to pick up a lot. One night I was out, I think I was I was still a squad leader, because I know who my platoon sergeant was, but our platoon leader was wounded, and he was like really right next to me, and he got shot through the legs, and he wasn't with us over there very long, and I didn't know him well, but He made it. He got sent back home. I do know that. And around New Year's, we were up on a railroad track, and this wasn't a Viet Cong. This was an NVA soldier, and he had some kind of rank. He was not a small guy in their organization, and he walked into an ambush that I was in charge of, and we captured weapons and also, importantly, documents from him. And for that action, I received the Bronze Star for valor. And what was really cool about that for me is my Uncle Eddie was in World War II, and he was my mother's little brother, her baby brother. And he was in the tanks, and he was in D-Day, and he was in all that stuff. He went all the way to Berlin, and he got the Bronze Star too, and she always used to talk about it. So I thought that would make her happy.
Okay. And any other awards that you got while you were over there?
I'm really proud of my combat infantry badge. It's a CIB, and that's for being in combat, for having been under fire, and fighting alongside of other men and helping each other. So I'm proud of that.
Okay. I think I remember that in February of 1970, you got a really bad infection.
The climate over there, or the conditions in which we were in, were crazy. And what I mean by that is I spent a lot of time literally in rice paddies. And the water was filthy. They used buffaloes to plow their fields and so forth to pull their little plows. And, the water was really dirty with buffalo feces and things like that. And I got an infection in my foot. And I had a little boil in the foot. And I asked the medic, I asked Doc to lance it. And he said, it's not a good idea. I said, what's the alternative? He said, I don't know. I said, well, it's hurting, so lance it. And in about a half an hour to an hour, my leg ballooned up like four times its size. And the captain, the company officer, he drove me back to Camp Eagle in a Jeep, and they got me to the hospital. In my memory, I was in the hospital for 10 days, or out of the field for 10 days. But in reality, I found out, just going through that, I was actually out like 21 days back there in the hospital. And I had a new platoon leader at that time. He's a lieutenant. He kind of held that against me for being out of the field. And it was sort of we didn't get off to a great start, and that kind of manifested into something later that actually has bothered me for a long time. And I've actually worked through that.
Okay. So let's talk about the importance of music and all this.
I don't think we could have this conversation without talking about the music of the day.
Right.
And you and I both love the Beatles.
Right.
Love the Beatles. And my parents sent me the Abbey Road cassette, and I had a cassette player. I could listen to it.
Well, that tells you how long ago it was.
Yeah.
It was a cassette.
Well, it was after 8-track.
True.
And I love that album, and I love Here Comes the Sun, and the reason I love Here Comes the Sun is because I always felt when I was in these lowlands that at night it was the most dangerous, and when the sun came up, nobody was going to mess with us. So I loved Here Comes the Sun. And that was written by George Harrison, and so was Something written by George Harrison. Not Lennon McCartney. And Something you and I danced to at our wedding. It was our wedding song.
It was our first dance at the wedding,
yeah.
Right?
And then you and I had a privilege, the honor, whatever. We were lucky enough, fortunate enough, that we got to walk across the crosswalk in Abbey Road, you and I did, in 2011.
Yep.
And we wrote a little message on the wall there at the Abbey Road Studios. And that was cool. And you also sent me the Bridge Over Troubled Waters cassette.
Right.
And
I think I wrote out all the words for it, too.
You probably did. And then you and I went to the live concert in New York in Central Park.
Simon and Garfunkel, live in the park.
September 1981. And you weren't there, but I actually got to meet Paul Simon in the early 2000s when he opened up the Cape Man.
Okay. So then in April, you got promoted.
I got promoted to Staff Sergeant E6, and that was a big deal. And just as a comment on the times, you were at Wilson College, and I was in Vietnam, and I sent you a clipping from Stars and Stripes, which was like the Armed Forces newspaper. And at your college, they protested Mamie Eisenhower.
I know.
Yeah. Poor Mamie Eisenhower.
Poor
that was
Mamie.
President Eisenhower's
well,
wife.
Well, the war was very, very, very difficult for many folks. And I actually was not there. So it was graduation, and it wasn't the year that I wasn't going to be graduating. So I didn't stick around. I took my exams, and I got out of there. But, yes, she was protested. The picture they sent was not so nice. That was in Stars and Stripes. And I felt divided. I mean, yes, I could understand the protest, but I felt so bad for Mamie Eisenhower. I don't know how old she was then, but, you know, Mamie wasn't the cause of the problem.
No, it was tough times. It was right after Kent State.
Yeah, it was right. Yeah, Kent State had happened
rough.
And all that. So what were the most traumatic things that happened to you?
At the end of June, we're in the mountains. We had walked a long time. We were looking for enemies, and I was on a listening post that night, and in the morning all three of us who were on the listening post were asleep, and that should not have happened. And my lieutenant, who was the guy that wasn't happy that I was in the hospital for 3 weeks, he told me that I wasn't going to be the platoon sergeant any longer, and I was going to be transferred to another duty. And that's, in fact, what happened. I didn't know this, but I found out he did the same thing to a friend of mine who was also his platoon sergeant. He got rid of him, so I don't think it was all me. And I don't even know why we all three of us were asleep. I never got to all of that. And then, ironically, amazingly, that happened in the morning. That night, we had a new guy in the company. He was in a squad. We were in a perimeter position up in the mountains, and the new guy, to relieve himself, he walked outside the perimeter, and he triggered one of our Claymore mines, and he blew his legs off. And the scream, I can still hear it.
I'm sure you can.
And I was the one who called in the helicopter to get him out of there, and I remember I said, what is his condition? And they told me extremely grave. And then the next morning I learned that he had died, and he was really a kid. A highlight, I guess, do you remember where I went to R&R?
Yeah, you went to Australia.
I went to Australia, and I had a really good time. It was really cold down there and everything. It was a completely different experience. I liked it. I think we should probably mention
the drugs and alcohol.
Drugs and alcohol were a big part of the Vietnam experience, and a lot of people smoked marijuana in Vietnam. I did, but not very much, but I drank a lot. And I got loaded over there a couple of times. So that's come up a couple of times. So I want to say that right now I haven't had a drink in 19 years and 10 months.
And it has sober. Made life better for all who know you.
And yeah.
And you.
Yeah. My daughters-in-law have never seen me drink. My grandchildren have never seen me drink.
All right. So toward the end of your tour, I know you were actually even struck by lightning.
I was. My whole platoon was struck by lightning. So that's one of the war stories I tell, because it wasn't a bad thing. It's not gruesome. Nobody got hurt. But I had 3 weeks to go before I was going home, and the whole platoon got struck by lightning. It was the loudest noise I ever heard. Claymore mines went off. Trees fell down. Our medic had diagnosed himself with a broken leg, and then it turned out he didn't have a broken leg, but the colonel was insistent that we send, in all this rain and lightning and thunder, that we send a helicopter in there to pull this kid out. And that was really amazing. You know, the last letter I wrote to you was from something called a fire support base, and it was on 20 December 1970. I guess I want to ask you, Well, I called you from Seattle. Do you remember that? I got home to Seattle.
I knew exactly. It was pretty close as to when you were supposed to hit the States. We, of course, didn't have cell phones or anything like that back then. So I was making sure no one could be near the payphone on the end of the hall until I got that phone call. And they didn't. So I got the phone call, yes.
It's a story for another day, but it took us forever to get processed out. It should have been one, like 24 hours, and it was like 3 days. I want to know, were you at any time worried that I would be killed or be severely wounded?
All the time.
All the time.
All the time. All the time.
So.
Okay, so looking back, what do you think about the war in you?
Well, I think a lot of folks now think we shouldn't have gotten involved at all. People that were for the war at the time have changed. Not everybody. I understand that. I think the Ken Burns PBS documentary has changed a lot of people's minds, but I really appreciate those that honor me as a Vietnam veteran and respect me. And I love living in Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is a very veteran-friendly town. I honor all who served. We went and we did a heck of a good job. I don't know why the politicians did what they did, but what the soldiers did was great. And as you know, mm-hmm. I was diagnosed with PTSD, and it really showed up in 2016, and I've been receiving counseling and treatment from the VA because of that.
Right. And what do you think about the job that you did? I think you pretty much said that already, that everybody on the ground did a great job.
I think they did. Some people, I wasn't a hero. I think I made some mistakes. I think I was competent, though. I never really lost a man. It may not sound like that from some of the stories I told you, but that I made a couple of friends, two of whom I'm still in contact with. And then we get to us, and, you know, I
hope, happened fast.
I hoped we'd become serious.
Well, and it did, and it happened fast.
I came home. We got together, and about a month later, we were engaged.
Yes, we were.
And that was 40. We got married. Not that wasn't 48 years ago, but we've been married for 40 years.
48 years.
48 years. Misspoke. And last year, a counselor pointed out to me that you kind of saved me. And I talked about the draft and all of that, but I think the Army really helped me. You know, at the time the draft notice came, I didn't have a great job. I hadn't finished college. I was living at home. I was dating a girl that I had no future with. And I think the Army was really good for me. Wasn't all that happy I had to go to the war, but the Army was really good for me. And with you, I finished college. I got an MBA. You finished college before I did. Later on, you got a master's degree. We have two wonderful sons. They each married wonderful women. And we have three beautiful grandchildren. And that really all happened because you wrote me that letter.
Yep.
And I was shy.
Love you.
Shy. I love you too. I love you a lot. So...